Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born in Reykjavik in 1962. He won the Nordic Council's Literary Prize for his novel The Blue Fox, the Nordic country's equivalent of the Man Booker. And the novel From the Mouth of the Whale was shortlisted for both the International Impact Dublin Literary Award and the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. Also a poet, librettist and lyricist, he's published 9 poetry collections, written 4 opera librettos and lyrics for various artists. In 2001, he was nominated for an Oscar for his lyrics in the film Dancer in the Dark. He's the president of the Icelandic Pen Centre and former chairman of the board of Reykjavik UNESCO City of Literature. His novels have been published in 35 languages, and his latest, Moonstone, The Boy Who Never Was, was awarded the 2013 Icelandic Literary Prize. Sigurjón Bigur Sigurðsson. I just knew I couldn't get that right, so I'm going to call you Sjón. Thanks so much for coming. How do you pronounce your full name?
Sigurjón Birgir Sigurðsson. It's all much softer. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But Sjón means sight.
Yes, Sjón means sight or vision, and it is really an abbreviation of my first name. Sigurjón, I took out the middle, and then there was Sjón. I was 15. I was just about to publish my first book of poetry. And it felt a little bit safer to have like an author's name on that book than my own name. But, you know, being a 15-year-old and quite sure of myself, I chose a name that reflected the fact that the poet is the eyes of the world.
How fantastic. And how very 15 at that time.
Absolutely.
So were you born into a literary background?
No, but... My family is a family of readers. I grew up with my mother. She was a single mom. And in our home, like in so many Icelandic homes, there is a home library. There is a small library. So I grew up with my mother reading. I started reading myself at the age of 6 and became a very voracious reader. I read everything. I read the newspapers. I read old weekly magazines. I just read everything I could lay my eyes on. And at the age of 8, when they started teaching us poetry in school, I just realized that poets were incredibly clever people. They created images out of words, and they had this wonderful way of ending the poems with a brilliant summary or a statement or a revelation.
And you went on to publish your own book, as you said, at 15.
Yes, yes. My first brush with the lyric arts was really the lyrics of David Bowie. I think most people today encounter verse or lyrics or language that has been transformed into some kind of poetry through music. So David Bowie, he had this wonderful way with words, and his experiments with cut-up technique that he learned from William Burroughs and Brian Gysin made for very strange lyrics. So I remember, you know, really trying to decode those when I was like 12, 13. But when I was 15, I discovered Icelandic modernist poetry. It was left out of the curriculum, so we were never introduced to it during my school years. But by coincidence, I came across a book selection, an anthology of the poets who stepped forward after the Second World War in Iceland. And it just blew my mind, you know. I became absolutely fascinated by the fact that you were allowed to do those things with the Icelandic language. Because those were like quite surrealist poems, many of them, you know. They were very daring, had strange metaphors, strange images. And, you know, this just got me started, you know. I just thought, I have to try this.
And you were involved, in fact, with the neo-surrealistic group Medusa.
Yeah, so I published my first book of poetry in the summer of 78. And I started high school in the autumn of 78. And there I met, you know, other young people who were writing and interested in poetry. And there was a group of young people in this high school who I discovered were also writing. And we somehow discovered that surrealism was what we were all interested in on some level, you know. We founded a surrealist movement of 7 called Medusa. And from 1979 to 85-86, we were quite active with publishing, making music. A part of the group formed a band called Van Houten's Coco, and we released cassettes. And we did performances, you know, and concerts and exhibitions, you know. We were trying to surrealize Iceland.
Mm. I mean, you were deeply involved in every aspect of the cultural scene, weren't you, in Reykjavik?
Yeah, well, in
and
those...
And still are,
yeah,
really.
Well, in those years, we were, of course, like, how do you say it in English? We were, like, staking our own ground, you know, because... Obviously, there were cultural institutions and there were proper publishers and all the gatekeepers of culture were there. But what my generation did, both in music and in literature, especially in music and literature, was to create our own ground. And, you know, just ignoring that there were gatekeepers. We just said we're going to do it our way. So we just started doing our things. And, of course, today we are... We are cultural institutions.
I mean, I wonder how much that means, given that the oft-quoted fact that every 10th person in Iceland is actually an author.
Let's say every 10th person in Iceland is a potential author. I'm happy to say that not every 10th person in Iceland publishes anything, you know. But every 10th person in Iceland has thought of publishing and writing. And there is something in our culture which gives people the confidence of just starting, of just writing. We all feel that we are entitled to call ourselves writers and authors and poets and to publish our books. And the antiquarian bookstores, they're full of amazing, strange literature published by people who may have just published one 70-page memoir, you know, in 1953 or something. Or there are three books of poetry by a taxi driver, you know, who self-published in the 80s, you know. So, yeah, in that sense, we are a literary nation because literature truly belongs to all of us, both as authors and readers.
And so tell me a little bit more about that literary landscape and the fact, because, of course, it was the UNESCO City of Literature and you were in charge of that.
Yes, Reykjavik is one of UNESCO's cities of literature. It was assigned that title in 2011, I think. We have a long history of literature and actually writing... in one form or another, is the only unbroken cultural activity in our country. The Icelandic sagas, the grand prose narratives written in Icelandic, they were written in the 13th century. And since then, you know, there has been a constant culture of writing. Not always what we would call fiction or poetry, sometimes annals and documentation or historical tellings. So it's the only unbroken cultural activity throughout the ages because... Iceland became extremely poor in the, I think I can say, the 15th century, 15th, 16th century, and stayed incredibly poor more or less until the second, third decade of the 20th century. It was what is sometimes called a third world country. Mm-hmm. But they kept writing and they kept reading. So, yes, we built on that. And then, of course, Halldór Laxness, the novelist, Icelandic novelist, won the Nobel Prize in 1955. And in a way, by doing that, he renewed our license after the sagas, you know. He renewed our license in the world of literature. Mm. So we have a great confidence in ourselves as a literary nation and literature people. So, yeah.
And the local chapter of PEN, the Writers' Human Rights Organization, is very strong and you lead that, do you?
Yes, yes, yes. I'm the president of the Icelandic PEN. We are very small, but we try to be active both at home and abroad, you know. We lend our name to all the big campaigns that International PEN, and we try to do our best. In my case, you know, the awareness, let's say, of the freedom of speech issues that are involved in writing, they've been with me for quite a while because that is a part of the surrealist narrative, you know. They were provoking, they were being censored, the French surrealists, you know. So right from the beginning, I was aware of the fact that literature can be so explosive or so displeasing to authorities that the authors are attacked and punished or killed even. So, yeah, so I was very happy when I was asked to take on the role as the president of Icelandic PEN.
And in fact, your own writing didn't stay just within poetry because you went on to write librettos, to write lyrics, to write novels. In what order did that all happen?
Well, I started as a poet and I think it was in 1987, I published my first book of prose, really. And what happened was that I had, in a way, just become tired of the fact that in the poem, the poet is always at its center. The poet is present and is at the center of the poem. And I really just wanted to work with a narrative and I wanted to work with characters. So I started writing novels And my main inspiration for my novel writing is The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, which I read when I was 18. And this book showed me that everything is possible in the novel. But at the same time, it showed me craftsmanship and masterful command, which I knew it would be difficult to achieve. But The Master and the Margarita was, you know, it set the benchmark for me. Yeah, so I started writing novels. And then, you know, in Iceland, it's a small community. And because, you know, I come from this group of people who were, you know, making music, visual arts, concerts, performances and all that, I have been doing collaborations from the beginning. So if somebody says, you know, well, we need a poster for a concert, they said, would you like to do the poster? You just say yes, and then you do a poster. Or one of the bands is canceling, you know, so could you read poetry between bands, you know, at this concert? You do it, you know. So we're just collaborating all the time.
Tell me about your involvement with the Sugar Cubes.
Yeah, so what happened in the 80s was that, let's say, those of us who started like in the late 70s and early 80s and continued, you know, writing and making music and whatever, the group got tighter and tighter, you can say, because people fell out of the group. Some people started family, some people went to university, moved abroad. But there was, a tight-knit group of people who was left from that big wave of talent and creativity in the early 80s. And the Sugar Cubes were formed in 86. They were formed around the concept of bad taste. There was a label formed called Bad Taste, or a label and a publishing house. And the Sugar Cubes, in a way, started with the idea to have fun, because the whole punk scene and the post-punk scene had become so serious. Everybody dressed in black, just singing about night, death and pain and all that. So the Sugar Cubes, you know, just became the opposite, you know. Everybody dressed in bright clothes, behaved silly and had fun. I was never in the Sugar Cubes. I was a friend of the band and I performed this one song with them.
Playing air guitar
and I did it all over the world. You know, they broke through here in England and they became a world phenomena. So all of a sudden, all my best friends who I had got to know as poor, struggling poets and musicians, all of a sudden they were all world famous. They were on the cover of every music magazine in the world, went on all the talk shows in the United States and the whole thing. So that was fun.
And this, of course, led ultimately to your nomination for an Academy Award. So tell me about Lars von Trier and Björk and writing that Dancing in the Dark.
Yeah, well, you know, the Sugar Cubes happened and then they quit and Björk started her solo career. When she was working on her second album, Post, she called me and said that she, you know, was struggling with lyrics for a specific song or that she was trying to find the right voice for it or whatever. And she thought that I might have the right way with words for that song. So I went to her house and I told her that I had never written lyrics before. So I asked her to teach me and she taught me how to write lyrics. And I wrote the lyrics for the song Isobel. And after that, I think I wrote two songs on the next album, which was called Homogenic. And shortly after, Lars von Trier approached Björk, first with the idea that she would write the music for the film. And then after they had met, you know, he offered her the main role. And Björk suggested me as the lyricist for the project. So I went with her to Denmark and we met Lars. And Lars and I, we discovered that we had quite many things in common, actually. So we got off very well. And yeah, in 3-4 sessions, I came to Denmark 3 or 4 times. The two of us stayed in a summer house in the north of Denmark. Lars did the cooking and I did the dishes. And we wrote the lyrics.
Fantastic.
And the movie turned out, I think, beautifully. It's a very powerful film. But I didn't follow the whole shooting of the film and all the troubles that happened then between Lars and Björk. But in the end, they finished the film. And I came to Copenhagen on the last day of shooting. And when I saw what they were doing and I saw the recording of one song, I just knew that we would get nominated. It was very strange. I just said to the producer of the film, "See you in Hollywood." I was so absolutely sure about it. And it happened.
How does that sense of musicality cross over into novel form? Because you've talked about your book, The Blue Fox, and how it has an almost symphonic structure.
Yes, you know, I listen very much to music. I'm surrounded by music all the time. My wife, Ásgerður Júníusdóttir, she's a mezzo-soprano, So she's involved both in classical music and works quite much with contemporary composers.
And she's brought you into opera, actually.
And she brought me into opera. It was through her that I got my first libretto commission, which was for an opera called Shadow Play, based on a story by Hans Christian Andersen. So I'm always working with musicians and alongside the writing of the novels. So it just helps, you know. It helps when I'm looking for the right tone for the prose, you know. There has to be a musicality in it. When the music is there, then I know I can finish the novel. And in the case of The Blue Fox, I had been working with the Brodsky Quartet on a project just before I started writing The Blue Fox. And during the process of trying to find form and tone for The Blue Fox, I discovered that the form of the string quartet was perfect for this book. So it became a string quartet, really. And I realized that the short novel has the same relationship to the grand epic novel as the string quartet has to the symphony.
Folklore and Nordic myth, of course, are huge parts of your work. And I wonder if those stories are universal.
You know, when you start looking at folk stories from different parts of the globe, you discover that people have been telling the same stories wherever they are, more or less the same stories. There is, for example, a Selkie story we have in Iceland called The Seven Children on Land and Seven Children in Sea, about the Selkie woman who comes ashore to dance on Midsummer Night, and the farmer, he steals her skin, her seal skin, so she can't return to the sea with the rest of her seal family. And he takes her for his wife, and he hides the skin, the seal skin. And then the years pass, and she has seven children with this farmer. And one day, she discovers the chest where he hides the seal skin, and she takes the seal skin, she goes down to the shore, and she is heard saying, seven children on land and seven children in sea, and she puts on the seal skin, and she returns to her family in the sea. I told this story to a class of 10-year-olds here in England, you know, I think some 15 years ago when I was here on literary business. And I thought, you know, I was telling them like a very Nordic, North Atlantic story. And of course I was. But at the end of the story, this girl at the back of the class raised her hand and said, well, we have the same story where I come from. And I looked at her and I said, and where are you from? I'm from Vanuatu, she said. And how is your story? I asked her. And she retold the story completely, but there were angels instead of seals. So the angels came down from the sky, they took off their wings, and they danced. And then this farmer, he stole the wings of one of the beautiful angel women and kept her like for Fantastic. Years, and then yeah. she returns to the sky. Mm. So those stories are everywhere. Mm. And this story, I think, is a great example of how much reality there is behind those stories. Because I think this story is really about a captive woman. It's about a woman who is captive in war. She's taken from her nation and brought to a new place as a captive, as a slave, you know. And she's taken as a wife there, and she's expected to have a whole life there. But her heart is always with the family mm-hmm. in the country she was kidnapped from. So there is a hard reality behind those stories. And that's why they are universal, and that's why they are being told in different forms all over.
Yeah.
And the same with myths, but on a grander scale. And in the myths, man, I think, is always trying to find his place within the grand universal forces.
And of course you do. You use historical fact a lot in your writing. The fact that it goes across so many countries and in so many languages, you've been translated into 35 different languages, I think, at the last count, relies so heavily on the fact that you have a brilliant translator, Victoria Cribbins. Tell me about her, because your relationship with her and the way we perceive your work now in English is absolutely key.
Yes, I was so, so lucky to find Victoria. You know, it came about, I think, 13 years ago. When I was actually here in London working with the Brodsky Quartet, I decided to use the fee I got for the work I was doing with them to have one of my Icelandic novels translated into English. I did not have a publisher or anything. I just thought, I want to have this one book in English so I can, you know, give it to my foreign friends so they see what I'm doing. Because, of course, it was a mystery to them. They knew I was an Icelandic author and I was quite well respected in Iceland, but they never could read anything. So I started looking around and saw something that Vicky had translated and decided to call her. And we met up And she did a sample translation from this book. And I really didn't need it, but she wanted to do it. And we started a relationship. So she translated two novels, two early novels, actually, before she translated The Blue Fox, which became like my breakthrough book in the world, because it received this Nordic Prize. And all of a sudden, you know, it started traveling. But Victoria Cripp, you know, she's really just a magician when it comes to translation. I know English well enough to cherish the text that she produces.
It is extraordinary. She's been lauded by so many people for having really understanding the poetry in your soul, I've heard it described as. You haven't always lived in Iceland, though, although you write in Icelandic. You lived here in Britain. You've also done a couple of spells in Germany.
Yes, I was the guest of the Berliner Künstler program in Berlin some years ago. It's a fantastic residential program where they invite authors, filmmakers, composers, and visual artists from all over the world to spend a year in Berlin. And they take complete care of you. They bring your family over. They give you a wonderful apartment and a good salary for a year. And they don't ask for anything, you know, anything from you, except that you live there and you experience Berlin. And it's a program that started in 62, 63. After the Berlin Wall came up, they built like this cultural bridge into West Berlin. And after the fall of the wall, they bravely did not cut it down. They said Berlin will always need good ambassadors and good cultural ties with the rest of the world. So I stayed in Berlin there and in 2010, 2011. And then I was there a few years earlier as a guest professor at the Freie Universität. So I have some ties with Germany. But I lived in Holland for half a year in the 80s. But Iceland is my home. Mm-hmm. Reykjavik is my home.
And you're very invested in it, including in the politics.
I took part in the happening that was the best party.
Anarchy is democracy.
Yes, anarchy is democracy. And one of the things that define my generation, if I can speak so broadly, is that we refused the politics of left and right. You know, we grew up in the Cold War. So when it came to being a poet or a musician or whatever, you were supposed to take sides. Either you went to the left, where most of the writers and intellectuals and everyone were, or to the right, you know, with mental kind of an isolation, but okay, they would take care of you. But my generation, inspired by punk, and just the word anarchy, you know, and anarchism, we just decided not to play along. And that was a part of this creating our own ground and denying the gatekeepers their authority. So in 2010, Jón Gnarr, who started out as a punk loitering at the city's bus terminal and later turned into a very fine anarchist surrealist poet, he got the idea to run for the city council and to become the mayor of Reykjavik. And he first introduced the idea to Einar Örn, who was the singer of the Sugar Cubes, because Jón Gnarr, he had been published, his first novel was published by Bad Taste, you know, the Sugar Cubes label and publishing house. So he talked to Einar and said, Do you want to join me in this? And Einar said yes, because we always say yes in Iceland if somebody asks you to do something, and especially if it's a little bit on the left side. And then they talked to me, and I said to Jon, well, but what are you going to do, Jon? I mean, we can do this, but you're going to be alone on the city council for 4 years, because we got so many instances of strange parties getting one member in the parliament or the city council or whatever. And he said, well, I think we are at least going to get 4 people, maybe 5, even a majority on the city council. And I thought, he really believes this, you know, so let's join it, you know. And in the municipal election in the summer of 2010, the best party, which was made up of people more or less from the Bad Taste catalogue of musicians and artists, you know, almost got majority on the city council. We were one person short. So we had to do real politics. Jón became the mayor. Einar Örn became like the chairman of the Council of Culture and Tourism. I went on the Human Rights Council. But we really had to do serious politics.
Which you hadn't really planned for.
No. Nobody had planned for it, you know. Yeah. So we brought our politics, which Jón always called anarcho-surrealism, to the city hall. And we were there for 4 years and ran the city for 4 years. And there were 4 good years for the city. we formed a coalition with the Social Democrats. And that was very, very interesting, because that is something that you always just read about in the papers. You know, the parties are trying to form a coalition. That's how it is in our part of the world. So it was very interesting for me, you know, because I've been interested in politics almost my whole life. So to all of a sudden to be there speaking to the foreman of the Social Democrats, and they had to take us seriously because we had the power, you know. And that was the strange thing for them, that all of a sudden they were sitting in a room, and in the room there were, like, you know, all these people from rock bands that they had actually been going to concerts with, you know, in their younger days and things like that. So it was strange, but it was wonderful. And Jón was a wonderful mayor.
Luckily, though, you're not doing that because it's given you time to write another book. And I want to talk about Moonstone, which is your most recent book, just been published in English. Moonstone, The Boy Who Never Was. And it seems that it comes down to an intensely personal story.
Yes, well, when I start writing my books or gathering material for my books, I reach into my reservoir of ideas and stories and historical material. In this case, I knew that I wanted to write a story about the Spanish flu, or the days of the Spanish flu in Reykjavik. And I started looking for a character to carry that story. Those were amazing weeks in the autumn of 1918. The volcano Katla started erupting in the middle of October. The Spanish flu came ashore in the beginning of November. And on the 1st of December, Iceland became a sovereign country. So it's a grand historical setting. And I started looking for a character that I could place there. And in the end, I came up with this 16-year-old kid who is dyslexic, orphan, unemployed, drifter in the town, who is selling sex to be able to go to the cinema because he's a cinephile. All of those things, you know, they came together and I started writing the book. And it was during the writing of the book that I realized that I was working with so many elements from my uncle's life that in the end, I dedicated the book to him and worked some of his characteristics into the main character. So the character, the character is also built on myself. You know, I was once a 16-year-old, you know, with a cinemania and all that. But
Were you giving handjobs?
No, I was not. No. So the difference between me and the main character is that I was not selling myself to strangers. I'm straight. He's gay. But, you know, we share so many other characteristics, you know, that I feel that there's a lot of me in his attitude towards society and his observations. But there's also quite a lot of my uncle in there. And it's a story of a plague and how this marginalized kid actually is pushed towards showing great compassion to the people who have been pushing him, you know, pushing him away and despise him. He shows them compassion when he starts helping out with the sick and the dying. And I realized that when you have like a plague and you have a gay character, you immediately have a story that mirrors the AIDS plague in the 80s and 90s. And this uncle of mine, Sævar Gyrdal, called Bósi, he died of AIDS in 93. So you can say that the moral urgency or emotional fuel of the novel comes from him and his story.
Moonstone, The Boy Who Never Was, is published in English by Scepter. It's available now. Sion, thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to Claire Urban, the producer. You can download the show and previous episodes from our website or from our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.